Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Mario Ritter and Anne Ball. Later, Steve Ember will bring us The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Mario Ritter.
Foods based on the latest biotechnologies will soon be available in grocery stores around the country. The first foods from plants or animals that have had their genetic material, or DNA, edited, are expected to appear on the market as early as next year. Genetically edited food uses a different technology from genetically modified, or GMO, foods, which are already available in many countries, including the U.S. The U.S. National Academy of Sciences says that gene editing is needed to improve food production in order to feed the world's growing population. However, governments do not yet know how to oversee this new tool. It also is unclear whether people will be willing to buy gene-edited foods. Dan Voitas is with Calixt Incorporated, which edited soybean DNA to give it new qualities. If the consumer sees the benefit, I think they'll embrace the products and worry less about the technology, he said. Researchers are using the technology to make several new kinds of crops. They include high-fiber wheat, mushrooms that keep their color, and highly productive tomatoes. They also are trying to develop corn that resists dry weather conditions and rice that resists pollution. Some scientists say they hope to use gene editing to end crop diseases like citrus greening, which affects fruits like oranges. However, they first must find the genes that could help a plant resist the disease. Fred Gemitter is a geneticist at the University of Florida Citrus Research and Education Center. He said if scientists can make small changes to a plant's DNA, then we'd have a way to defeat this disease. For hundreds of years, farmers have genetically changed crops and animals by breeding them for desired qualities. This selective breeding results in giving up some other qualities. For example, modern tomatoes are much bigger than their wild ancestors, but they are more easily damaged and have different nutrients. GMOs, or genetically modified organisms, are plants and animals that have had DNA from other kinds of organisms mixed with their own to give the new organism a specific quality. Examples of this are corn or soybeans that have had bacterial genes added to make them resistant to insects or plant-killing chemicals. Scientists around the world say GMOs are safe to eat. but that does not keep some people from not liking them. Some people also worry that GMOs will bring unexpected results as they interact with other living things in the natural world. Now there are gene editing tools with names like CRISPR and TALENs. Scientists hope these methods will permit very exact changes to plant or animal DNA without necessarily adding DNA from another organism. These methods act like scissors that can cut off molecules in an organism's DNA. Scientists say this process could be less costly. So far, researchers have placed most of their efforts not on adding to DNA, but on cutting unwanted parts from genes, causing them to turn off. The new soybeans, developed by Calixt, have two genes that have been turned off in this way. The genes cause the plant to produce trans fats, forms of fat that have been linked to heart disease. The company Recombinetics Incorporated says it has turned off part of a gene that makes Holstein cows grow horns, making them safer to other cows and farmers. The U.S. Agriculture Department says extra rules are not needed for plants that could otherwise have been developed through traditional breeding. The Food and Drug Administration, however, in 2017, proposed new rules for gene-edited animals. It has promised to give its opinion on the subject sometime next year. At the World Trade Organization this month, the U.S. joined 12 nations, including Australia, Canada, Argentina, and Brazil. They called for other countries to accept international rules for gene-edited agricultural products. Companies involved in gene editing also want to avoid reactions similar to those that met GMO foods when they were introduced years ago. Many people reject them, and the European Union has laws limiting their sale and use. Jennifer Kuzma is with the Genetic Engineering and Society Center at North Carolina State University. She said it is important to make sure gene-edited products are safe. But she expects about 20 gene-edited crops will arrive on the U.S. market over the next 5 years. She also said that scientists are studying crops important to the poorest countries, like cassava. "We think it's going to really revolutionize the industry," she said. I'm Mario Ritter.
Young women in Kyrgyzstan are reaching for the stars.
They are working to build and launch the country's first satellite before 2020. A small group of female scientists has been working with computers and other equipment since March to build a CubeSat. The American space agency, NASA, has described CubeSat as the smallest and cheapest satellite used for space exploration. I'm very proud that it's going to be the first satellite of the country, said 23-year-old student Kizabak Batir Kanova. I'm doing this because I want to empower other girls, she said. Batir Kanova added that a person's gender, whether you are male or female, doesn't have to determine what you do in this life. She spoke to the Reuters news agency on Skype from Bishkek, the Kyrgyz capital. Kyrgyzstan is a mountainous country where nearly two-thirds of the people live in rural areas. The United Nations notes that the local economy depends heavily on farming. So it is rare for any Kyrgyz to choose technology as a career path. The UN Development Program studied records about the country's college graduates in science, technology, engineering, mathematics, construction, and manufacturing. It found that women make up less than 10% of those graduates. 19-year-old Alina Anisimova is a computer programmer who leads the CubeSat project. She told Reuters, some girls don't have the courage to take on such studies because it is not common in their country. And she said, the majority of parents discourage their daughters from studying these subjects. Anisimova said she wishes that in the future, people will not consider it so surprising to see young women involved in engineering and metalworking. She is one of the young women, ages 17 to 24, who are working on the project. It was started by Clope Media, a local media group, after a chance meeting with Alexander McDonald, a NASA official. McDonald suggested the idea of building the satellite. He told Reuters that building a satellite can serve as a powerful social and political signal or sign. McDonald said it could send important messages about who is able to participate and build the future. Clope created a crowdfunding page to raise money for the project. It says the manufacture and launch of Kyrgyzstan's first CubeSat will cost up to $150,000. The final part of the device will be made with a Lithuanian company. The number of women in science, technology, engineering, and math areas has increased in recent years. In the United States, there has been a push to get more girls interested in such subjects at an early age. Still, the UN's cultural agency, UNESCO, notes that only about 30% of the world's researchers are women. Aydana Aydabakova is a 19-year-old student involved in the project. She said girls and women in her country are expected to marry instead of having careers. There are a lot of people who don't believe that girls are capable of doing anything else but cleaning and cooking and giving birth to children, Aydabakova said. Nearly 1 in 10 girls in Kyrgyzstan is married before age 18, notes the International Aid Group girls, not brides. Ida Bakova said she hopes the space project will inspire girls in Kyrgyzstan and other countries. We are doing this program because we want to prove that girls can actually do it, she said. Maybe our project will give hope to girls all around the world. I'm Anne Ball.
Today on The Making of a Nation, we tell about slavery and how it affected the history of the United States. Here is Steve Ember.
Slavery is the custom of one person controlling or owning another. Some historians say it began following the development of farming about 10,000 years ago. People forced prisoners of war to work for them. Other slaves were criminals or people who could not repay money they owed. It is said the first known slaves lived more than 5,000 years ago in the Sumerian society of what is now Iraq. Slavery also existed among people in China, India, Africa, the Middle East, and the Americas. It expanded as trade and industry increased. This increase created a demand for a labor force to produce goods for export. Slaves did most of the work. Most ancient people thought of slavery as a natural condition that could happen to anyone at any time. Few saw it as evil or unfair. In most cities, slaves could be freed by their owners and become citizens. In later times, slaves provided the labor needed to produce products that were in demand. Sugar was one of these products. Italians established large sugar farms beginning around the 12th century. They used slaves from Russia and other parts of Europe to do the work. By the year 1300, African blacks had begun to replace the Russian slaves. They were bought or captured from North African Arabs, who used them as slaves for years. By the 1500s, Spain and Portugal had American colonies. The Europeans forced native Indians to work in large farms and mines in the colonies. Most of the Indians died from European diseases and poor treatment. So the Spanish and Portuguese began to bring in people from West Africa as slaves. France, Britain, and the Netherlands did the same in their American colonies. England's southern colonies in North America developed a farm economy that could not survive without slave labor. Many slaves lived on large farms called plantations. These plantations produced important crops traded by the colony, crops such as cotton and tobacco. Each plantation was like a small village owned by one family. That family lived in a large house, usually facing a river. Many separate buildings were needed on a plantation. For example, a building was needed for cooking. and buildings were needed for workers to produce goods such as furniture that were used on the plantation. The business of the plantation was farming, so there also were barns for animals and buildings for storing and drying crops. There was a house to smoke meat so it could be kept safely, and there was a place on the river from which goods were sent by ship to England. The plantation owner controlled the farm and saw that it earned money. He supervised, fed, and clothed the people living on the property, including the slaves. Larger plantations might have 200 slaves. They worked in the fields on crops that would be sold or eaten by the people who lived on the plantation. They also raised animals for meat and milk. Field slaves worked very long and hard. They worked each day from the time the sun rose until it set. Many of these slaves lived in extreme poverty in small houses with no heat or furniture. Sometimes 5 or 10 people lived together in one room. House slaves usually lived in the home of the plantation owner. They did the cooking and cleaning in the house. House slaves worked fewer hours than field slaves, but were more closely supervised by the owner and his family. Laws approved in the southern colonies made it illegal for slaves to marry, own property, or earn their freedom. These laws also barred slaves from receiving an education or even learning to read. But some owners permitted their slaves to earn their freedom or gave them money for good work. Other owners punished slaves to get them to work. The punishments included beatings, withholding food, and threatening to sell members of a slave's family. Some plantation owners executed slaves suspected of serious crimes by hanging them or burning them alive. Historians say that people who were rich enough to own many slaves became leaders in their local areas. They were members of the local governments. They attended meetings of the legislatures in the capitals of their colonies, usually 2 times a year. Slave owners had the time and the education to greatly influence political life in the southern colonies, because the hard work on their farms was done by slaves. Today, most people in the world condemn slavery. That was not true in the early years of the American nation. Many Americans thought slavery was evil, but necessary. Yet, owning slaves was common among the richer people in the early 1700s. Many of the leaders in the colonies who fought for American independence owned slaves. This was true in the northern colonies as well as the southern ones. One example is the famous American diplomat, inventor, and businessman Benjamin Franklin. He owned slaves for 30 years and sold them at his general store. but his ideas about slavery changed during his long life. Benjamin Franklin started the first schools to teach blacks and later argued for their freedom. Slavery did not become a force in the northern colonies, mainly because of economic reasons. Cold weather and poor soil could not support such a farm economy as was found in the South. As a result, the North came to depend on manufacturing and trade. Trade was the way colonists got the English goods they needed. It was also the way to earn money by selling products found in the New World. New England became a center for such trade across the seas. The people who lived there became shipbuilders so they could send the products to England. They used local wood to build the ships. They also sold wood and wood products. They became businessmen carrying goods around the world. The New England shipbuilding towns near the Atlantic Ocean grew quickly as a result. The largest of these towns was Boston, Massachusetts. By 1720, it had more than 10,000 people. Only two towns in England were larger, London and Bristol. More than 25% of the men in Boston had invested in shipping or worked in it. Ship captains and businessmen held most of the public offices. The American colonies traded goods such as whale oil, ginger, iron, wood, and rum, an alcoholic drink made from sugar cane. Ships carried these goods from the New England colonies to Africa. There they were traded for black Africans who became slaves in the American colonies. The Africans had been captured by enemy tribesmen and sold to African slave traders. The New England ship captains would buy as many as they could put on their ships. Conditions on these ships were cruel. The Africans were crowded together and forced to travel in areas so small they could hardly move. Some were kept in chains. Many killed themselves rather than live under such conditions. Others died of health disorders they caught on the ship. Yet many did survive the trip and became slaves in the southern colonies or in the Caribbean islands. Black slaves were needed to work on Caribbean sugar plantations. The southern American colonies needed them to work on the tobacco and rice plantations. By 1750, almost 25% of the total number of people in the American colonies were black slaves. From the 1500s to the 1800s, Europeans sent about 12 million black slaves from Africa to America. Almost 2 million people died on those slave ships. Historians say English ships carried the greatest number of Africans into slavery. One slave ship captain came to hate what he was doing and turned to religion. His name was John Newton. He stopped taking part in the slave trade and became a leader in the Anglican Church. He is famous for having written the song Amazing Grace.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.